Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. And today, what we're going to do is continue the discussion from last week. If you recall, last week we were talking about the failures of monetary policy in the U.S., particularly the U.S. Federal Reserve, the central bank, its policies of QE, quantitative easing, and so forth. And we just sort of began talking about fiscal policies, fiscal meaning government spending, questions of debt, taxes, and so forth. We're going to pick up that thread here and talk about fiscal policy, which is at the center of news today, isn't it? The government shutdown, the debt ceiling crisis. Both of those are fiscal issues, and we want to address those today. I'll give you my interpretation of what's going on here with this extended fight in Congress between the Republican faction of the Republican Party in the House, U.S. House of Representatives, and the Obama administration. What's behind this extended fight over funding the federal government and over paying the bills that the government owns, which is called the debt ceiling, raising the debt ceiling so that they can pay the bills. Okay, borrow money to pay the bills. Two related issues. And, of course, at the center of all this is the Obamacare law and its role as a bargaining tool by the Republicans in the government shutdown and debt ceiling negotiations that are continuing. Okay, my guest today, and I will be talking about this Obamacare law and its role in these fiscal discussions about the government shutdown and the debt ceiling. My guest is Dr. Margaret Flowers, a longtime public health advocate and journalist, an advocate for Medicare for All as the solution to the health care crisis in this country, a position that I share with her. She's also a member of the Green Shadow Cabinet and a co-host for the radio show Clearing the Fog in Washington, D.C., and a longtime activist with the Occupy movement there. There's a lot more I can say about Margaret. She's really quite remarkable in terms of her activity. But I will introduce her shortly, and we will talk, excuse me, about Obamacare and what it looks like today, as well as its role in these political negotiations. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the debt ceiling crisis and the government shutdown. Okay, we have today the Republican faction using Obamacare as a lever to extract even bigger spending cuts than Obama has proposed in his 2014 budget, specifically on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. If you noticed over the past weekend, House Speaker Boehner came on TV, and he pretty much said what his original position was back in August, and that was they, the Republicans, were going to use the debt ceiling issue and the default, and the government shutdown, as a way of forcing the government, forcing the Obama administration into even bigger cuts than Obama had proposed in his 2014 budget, bigger cuts particularly in Social Security and Medicare. If you look at his 2014 budget produced earlier this year, Obama already proposed $630 billion in cuts in Social Security and Medicare. Now, we talked about those two programs before and provided evidence that they really aren't in crisis. There isn't a crisis of funding Medicare or funding Social Security. There is a crisis with some of the programs within Social Security and Medicare. Disability, Social Security disability is running a negative balance. Why is it running a negative balance? Because we have so much unemployment, and it's been such a protracted, slow recovery, if you can even call it that, in jobs, and we've had an increase in people going on SSDI. So the SSDI program within Social Security needs additional funding, but the retirement program doesn't. And the same thing with Medicare. Medicare is not in trouble. The prescription drug program, which has never been funded since its inception in 2005, never passed any tax to fund prescription drugs, always paid for it out of deficits. Yes, that needs a tax to properly fund it. And what happens is you're running problems in those two programs, Part D, prescription drugs and Medicare, and SSDI and Social Security, and that's the source of the problem, and it can be solved very simply by very small tweaks in the funding, 0.25% to fund SSDI, and 0.25% in the payroll tax to fund prescription drugs, and you have no problem whatsoever. Okay. So Obama, though, is proposing $630 billion, but that's not enough for the Tea Publicans. No, nowhere near enough. They want to destroy Social Security. They want to destroy Medicare. So they want to extract even bigger concessions. And as Boehner said back in August, their plan is to do it by leveraging government funding and the debt ceiling crisis. Two levers here. Let the government shut down. Let's have a debt ceiling crisis, and we will use that to force Obama to cut even bigger. Okay, but what happened in September was the Tea Publican faction, both in the House and the Senate, which is growing more and more powerful within the Republican Party, by the way. It's already at a point that moderate Republicans are terrified of the radicals. And they're pandering to the radicals in their base and do whatever they want them to do. They've almost, the Republicans, the radicals, have almost taken over the Republican Party. And you see it with John Boehner. He wants to stay in office as the Speaker of the House and the Republican majority, so he caters to them. And, of course, what happened was they injected their political demands into this whole negotiations, and they upset the traditional Republican Boehner strategy of let's use debt default and government shutdown to extract even bigger spending concessions, particularly in entitlements, Social Security, Medicare. Let's engage in that strategy. Well, the Tea Publicans injected Obamacare into the mix here, and they're all grandstanding. Look, this is not about October 2013. This is about October 2014 and the November 2014 midterm elections. That's what all of this is about. And even Obama standing firm is about that as well. Obama knows he's accomplished virtually nothing in terms of domestic policy over 6 years, and he's got one more shot. And to have that shot, he's got to get a majority in the House of Representatives and prevent a Republican takeover in the Senate, which is possible, because far more Democrats are up for election in the Senate than Republicans. He knows he's got one more shot at this, or his legacy is what? Oh, it's a health care bill, Obamacare, which, as we'll talk shortly, has many holes in it, and as I've predicted, if it continues, the fight on its current trajectory will implode by 2016 election. Okay, and what else has he got? Well, he's got this even more full of holes financial regulation bill, which has been picked apart for 4 years now and hardly exists. It's hard to find anything else that he has really accomplished. Well, of course, the Tea Publicans have made darn sure that he wasn't going to accomplish anything. They're largely responsible for this. On the other hand, so is Obama, because his policies in 2009 and 10, we talked about it, enabled the Tea Publicans to get in, take control of the House in November 2010, midterm elections. And ever since then, it's been a rearguard reaction or action on the part of Obama. So that's the grand politics of all this. This is all about 2014 midterm elections And the Republicans see, and the Tea Publican faction see, an opportunity really to get control of the congressional lever as the next step to gaining control of the presidential lever in 2016. And then you ain't seen nothing yet. You think today is a dangerous rightward swing. If they succeed, it will be even more dangerous. Okay, so the stakes are very high here. And the Tea Publicans have injected Obamacare into the traditional Republican strategy of using government funding and debt ceiling. And that's complicated the whole situation. Okay. Keep in mind, for 4 years now, or 3 years, what we've seen since August 2011 is we've always had a deficit-cutting attempt congruent with a debt ceiling default threat. The two go hand in hand. We saw that in August 2011, right? What was the outcome in August 2011, the last debt ceiling default crisis? Well, the outcome was Obama and the Democrats agreed to $1 trillion in spending cuts. That wiped out his previous year, his first year, 2009, stimulus program, $787 billion. Well, a year later, 2 years later, 18 months later, we turn around and we take away even more. We have been engaging in austerity American style since 2010. A rolling kind of austerity, unlike in Europe where they do it all at once. It's been a rolling austerity program. And the consequence of the first debt ceiling fight in August 2011 was $1 trillion in spending cuts. What did the Democrats and Obama get for it? Nothing except for themselves. They got an agreement from the Republicans not to raise the debt ceiling tactic again until after the November 2012 elections. That's all they got. They got no tax hikes on the rich. They got nothing. Republicans got everything. Well, it worked for them back in August 2011. They extracted, using the debt ceiling as the lever, as the hammer, as the threat, $1 trillion in spending cuts, mostly education and so forth. Okay. Then we saw the fiscal cliff. Remember that last year? The fiscal cliff. What was the fiscal cliff about? Well, it was about another $1.2 trillion in spending cuts that went into effect, were supposed to go into effect on January 1st of this year. That was also part of the August 2011 debt ceiling deal, $1 trillion then and $1.2 trillion in January 2013. But it was also about an even bigger issue, and that was the Bush tax cuts, which also expired on January of this year. Now, both of those together, the Bush tax cuts extensions and the sequestered $1.2 trillion spending cuts, were called the fiscal cliff. And they both came to a head on January 1st, 2013. Now, the Bush tax cuts were a far bigger plum. $4.6 trillion were at stake over the next decade. $4.6 trillion in tax cuts, 80% of which went to corporations and wealthy investors and households. $4.6 trillion, that's not my number, that's the Congressional Budget Office number. Now, they really wanted those tax cuts extended, continued. That was the big issue in the fiscal cliff last year. There's $1.2 trillion. Yeah, that was no small change, but the tax cuts were the big plum. And what was the outcome? The outcome was the Tea Publicans got what they want again. What did they get? They got the extension of $4 trillion in tax cuts over the next decade. $4 trillion. The Bush tax cuts. Oh, we raised taxes on the super wealthy, $60 billion a year. It's not really $60 billion. If you look at it very closely, you know, that's an exaggeration because we gave the super wealthy even bigger inheritance tax cuts. An alternative minimum tax was liberalized. So, you know, while they paid with the right hand a little bit, they took with the left hand back again. I estimate it's about $30-40 billion. So $4 trillion and 30 versus $30-40 billion. What a deal. And those Bush tax cuts were made permanent. They came out smelling like roses. And what about the sequestered cuts, the $1.2 trillion? Well, they were put off until March of this year, 2 months, and then they went into effect. So we've got $2.2 trillion in spending-only cuts and a measly $30-40 billion a year in tax hikes. That's the picture so far. Well, their strategy has been working quite well. No wonder they came for another bite at the apple this time around. Let's do this again. Let's shut down the government. Let's threaten a debt ceiling default. And in addition, we will get even more cuts. And Obama's already agreed to $630 billion in Social Security and Medicare, signaled for free. Well, we'll take that and we'll double it, at least. And that's what's going on. That's what's going on. Okay? What we got is a repeat of August 2011, December 2012, fiscal cliff. Those two things are really one event, and now we got it being repeated again. But this time it's all telescoped. Instead of all 2011 completed in 2012, it's all happening at once, both of them together. They're not split. And that's why it's more intense, and that's why it's even more dangerous, because the U.S. economy is really slowing. You know, if you read the press, you think we got a recovery going. There's no real recovery going. Oh, there's a recovery of stock markets and bond markets and wealthy folks and the wealthiest house 10% households, right? And the wealthiest 1%, latest economic data from the University of California, economists showed that since 2009, this recovery, and last year in particular, the wealthiest 1% got 95% of all the income gains in this country. 95% of the recovery in income terms went to the wealthiest 1%. Are you going to tell me there's a recovery going on when they get 95% of it? I mean, that's worse than even under George W. Bush. Under George W. Bush, they got, between 2001 and 2007, they got 65%. And before that, under Bill Clinton in the 90s, they got 50% of all the income gains. So they're going from 50% to 65%. Now it's 95%. Is that a recovery? No, that's the best indicator of recovery. Don't give me GDP, which is questionable in a number of ways. But who's getting the money? Follow the money trail, and you'll see that who's gotten the recovery. Okay. So they're doing quite well. But the economy, for the rest of us, is not doing quite well. It's growing slower and slower. And in fact, even the Federal Reserve has downgraded four times now its projections for economic growth in the U.S. Four times. Globally, the International Monetary Fund has also been downgrading its forecasts for global economic growth. The global economy is slowing, and the U.S. economy is really slowing, not growing. You wouldn't know it, though, if you read the press. And now, what we've got are the Tea Republican faction taking us to the brink once again and saying, you know, government shutdown, so what? That's only 800,000 workers. Government workers lose their job. We don't care about them anyway. And, debt ceiling. They're actually coming out and saying in the press that the debt ceiling, if we default, isn't going to have any economic effect. That the government will still get some money. Some money will be coming in. Okay, and, you know, that some money, they could use that to pay the bondholders. The Republicans and the Tea Republicans want a debt default because that's going to put Obama in a real box. That's going to make him choose between, given the limited amount of money the government has coming in, whether he's going to pay the bondholders and not default on the debt, or whether he's going to take it from grandma and grandpa's Social Security checks. That's the Hobson's choice they're presenting him. We'll see what he does. They want a default. But they're saying it's not going to have any effect on the economy because, you know, go ahead and pay the bondholders and take it out of grandma and grandpa's income. So there won't be a default. Okay, but if it doesn't come out of grandma and grandpa, all of it, and there is a debt default, then it will have significant impact on the U.S. and global economy. I've just written a piece about this. You can read it on my blog, jackrasmus.com, and also some other public blogs, or on the greenshadowcabinet.org website, where it will be posted later today. Yes, the debt ceiling, if not extended, will have economic consequences. Unavoidable, unless, of course, Obama does what the Republicans want him to do, and that is take it out of grandma and grandpa's checks and give it to the bondholders. Well, what could happen? What could happen here? And it's important to understand that the economic consequences don't require a default date. First of all, what is the debt ceiling default? The administration says it's October 17th. No, it's not. There's still money in the pot. And how much longer they can go after that is not clear. Probably a couple weeks. The real debt ceiling default is somewhere around the end of October, maybe early November. Okay. But you don't have to wait until you have technical default to have economic impacts. The psychological effects of all this will be significant even before we get there. What are some of the possible impacts then? Okay, first of all, rising interest rates. Now, we already see interest rates, long-term rates, that have been rising over the summer because the Federal Reserve bungled its attempt to signal its tapering or reducing of its QE, $85 billion a month, free money liquidity injections into bankers and finance and investors. Okay, it signaled that over the summer. We talked about that last week. Bungled the whole process, and interest rates have risen over 1%, especially mortgage rates. And it's brought the whole housing, quote, housing recovery, which wasn't much of a recovery, mostly refis, it's brought it to a virtual halt. It's not by accident that Chase Bank and Wells Fargo and all the others have recently announced thousands of layoffs in its mortgage servicing department. They know the recovery in housing is over, and they're laying people off. So forget that. Interest rates are rising in housing, in mortgages, and in other long-term rates as well, bond rates and so forth. Now, what will happen is that short-term interest rates will also start accelerating as this debt crisis, debt ceiling crisis continues. And in fact, they already are. Watch for Treasury bill rates to rise and other short-term rates that follow Treasury bills. And watch the extremely important short-term market called the repo market. The repo market is basically what banks borrow by putting up their collateral from each other. It's a short-term market. And they are way overextended in this market. It's a threat to future financial instability. The government's trying to reform it, but can't get its hands around it. These rising rates could very well destabilize the repo market and lead to another financial crash. It's a long shot, but not impossible. The repo market is kind of like the subprime mortgage market of the last decade. It's that critical. So Republicans are playing a very dangerous game. And this whole debt ceiling fight may precipitate problems in the repo and other short-term markets. But even if they don't, rising short-term rates at some point are going to cause the stock and junk bond markets to collapse. We can see a sharp retraction. Now, of course, that'll affect the incomes of rich folks. Most of us don't play in the stock market, right? But the psychological impact of a decline in stock and bond prices typically spills over to consumer and business spending. That can lead to layoffs. In a job market that's already producing at best in the U.S. part-time, temp, and low-pay jobs. Okay, rising rates, interest rates, not only will weaken job creation in the U.S., but retail sales, which are already weak. Retail outlets had the worst back-to-school period of sales here in recent weeks than many years. And it looks like it's going to be a really poor Christmas sales cycle. All right. The negative impact of a debt default, the psychological impact approaching a debt default on consumption is becoming evident. There's a recent Gallup poll in recent days showing consumer confidence dropping precipitously. Now, some economists argue that confidence surveys are typically volatile and unreliable indicators of consumer spending, but when there is an abrupt and significant movement in confidence indicators, as just is happening now, that does impact future consumer spending. This poll fell from minus 15 to minus 35 here in just a matter of 2 weeks. Now, minus 15 means you're 15 index points below the peak. Well, we went from 15 to 35 in just 2 weeks. Keep in mind, during the 2008 crash, when consumer spending really tanked, the number was minus 66. So we're halfway there. We went from 15 to 35, halfway to 66. That's unprecedented short-term movement here. It could get very worse if this debt ceiling thing continues. Now, globally, we have problems as well with the debt ceiling default or approaching a default. Now, foreign governments are already telling the U.S., China, Japan, Europe, right? If they don't do something about resolving this debt ceiling issue, they're going to stop buying U.S. bonds. Oh, that's going to be really nice, because if they stop buying U.S. bonds, then they've got to cut spending even more. Well, why shouldn't they? If bond prices are falling, why should they continue to buy something that's declining in price and value? They're going to stop buying U.S. bonds. There are other important developments, too, because if there's a debt ceiling crisis in the U.S., that means the value of the dollar collapses and the value of other currencies rise correspondingly, particularly the euro. And if the euro currency rises, then German and European exports fall, and that region's very tepid recovery, last quarter only 0.3% after 2 years of recession, that will come to a halt. And there's problems in the European banking system as well. You know, their central bank loaned $1.5 trillion, equivalent of $1.5 trillion to bail out their banks here last year. And now they got to repay all that. Well, if interest rates rise, the banks are going to be even more difficult in Europe, particularly the Italian banks, very fragile. The same thing we can say about what's happening, similar slowdown will happen in Japan and emerging markets and so forth. So this thing is serious. And again, you don't have to technically default. You just have to be approaching it to have these psychological effects. All right, let me finish up on this by saying that for the last 18 months, I've been writing that a fragile U.S. economy and global recovery, not as nearly as robust as some maintain, is susceptible to a double-dip recession later this year and 2014. I was saying that 18, 24 months ago. Now, I said, qualify that by saying, what would precipitate a double-dip recession in the U.S. would be one or more of the following events. First, the renewed banking crisis in Eurozone. Second, further deficit cutting in the U.S. And third, a continued drift upward of U.S. long-term interest rates as a consequence of QE. While it appears the Euro banking crisis has temporarily stabilized, temporarily emphasis here, except for Italian banks, the deficit cutting and the interest rate rises are occurring in the U.S. right as we speak, and we are approaching this double-dip recession cliff as a result of this government shutdown, as a result of this deficit spending, as a result of this debt ceiling crisis. Okay, I've had my say, my fill on the fiscal situation here. Now, at the center of all this is Obamacare, right? This is the lever. This is the tactic that's being used to really hammer home the Republicans and Republicans' attempt to extract even more concessions, more spending cuts from the administration. What they're doing to Obama and the Democrats is saying, look, you either cut Obamacare, or if you don't want to, then, you know, you cut Social Security and Medicare. Boehner, Social Security, Medicare, Ryan and T-Publicans, Obamacare, or a little bit of each. This is what they want. Okay. We're going to take a short break here. I'm going to let my guest, Margaret Flowers, really have her say on what's happening with Obamacare. We want to know is what's happening with the introduction of Obamacare, right? What's happening with all these exemptions and concessions Obama's made so far to date, exempting businesses and so forth, the mandates, et cetera. What's happening with the premiums? You know, are they really rising? And I'll have something to say about that for those who already have insurance. Yes, they are. Are the penalties sufficient to get adequate enrollment? Right? Are the subsidies sufficient for people to enroll, et cetera, et cetera? But first, let's take a break. We're going to come back and let Margaret, who's the expert on this, speak forth. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions, Fiscal Cliff, Fiscal Crisis, Debt Ceiling, Obamacare. Be back in a moment. This is your host, Jack Rasmus. The show's Alternative Visions. And I'm going to turn next to my guest here, Margaret Flowers. We're going to talk about Obamacare specifically. I talked about its strategic linchpin role in this debt ceiling shutdown situation and what all that means. But let's talk about Obamacare itself specifically. You know, there's been a lot of concessions made here by Obama, not just on the employer mandate, putting off small businesses of complying here for another year, but other concessions earlier this year. And now we got the rollout going, and it's kind of mixed. I can't really, a lot of people calling in, some people signing up and so forth. But are they signing up, Margaret, for plans with very high thousands of dollars of deductibles just to get some catastrophe insurance here? What's going on? What's your take on the rollout of Obama, the Obamacare Act?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me, Jack. And this is such a huge topic. I think to start out with, what's important for the listeners to know is that we used to try to hold the bar to require that insurers covered at least 80% of a person's health care costs. And what the Affordable Care Act has done, and it's not really affordable, so I kind of hate to call it that, but what the law has done is it's lowered that bar significantly. So people are now required to purchase insurance if they don't otherwise have it or qualify for a public program like Medicaid through these exchanges where the least expensive plans are 60% coverage, which is just really grossly underinsured. The only plans that you can get a government subsidy for to help you pay for start at the silver level, which is 70% coverage, again, which is very what we consider underinsured. So the Affordable Care Act is at its best. It's going to leave out tens of millions of people. The Congressional Budget Office believes that it will be at least 31 million people that will remain uninsured. We currently have 48 million. So it will grossly increase the number of people who have insurance but aren't able to actually afford health care when they need it.
So you're saying that only 17 million is the projected target to sign people up? If there's 48 million uninsured and 31 million are going to remain uninsured under this act, where we're spending all that we're doing here on this plan to insure just 17 million? Is that what it is?
Well, they say it may be as many as 25. That 31 million figure is over the next, like, 5 years. So when the bill is fully implemented in 2019, they expect that about 31 million people will still be uninsured. I think it'll actually be higher than that. But you hit it on the nail on the head. We're spending hundreds of millions of dollars to create this kind of market where people will be driven to buy insurance that's completely inadequate. And the language that we're hearing being used to describe this plan, you know, that, oh, well, now, you know, the insurance companies are going to be regulated, so they're going to behave better. What we're seeing instead is the usual game. They've done this for decades, so it's nothing new, that the insurers know how to cut their costs. They know how to cut their spending on actual health care so they can protect their profits. And so they're just working around any of the regulations that are involved, you know, included in this legislation.
Yes, you know, I'm really concerned that not only is the coverage in most cases going to be inadequate, because that's all people can afford, but what happens to the folks that already have health insurance, both those who have it in union employer-negotiated health insurance plans and those who are on the market and have bought insurance individually? Both cases, they're insured in both cases already. What's going to happen to them?
Well, so if we look at the people who have their health insurance through their employer, and that's like around 55% of the population gets their insurance through their employer, you know, we've done nothing in the Affordable Care Act to actually control health care costs. There are no proven cost controls built into it. We know what works for cost controls, but those things were not included in the Affordable Care Act. Instead, they're playing this game of experimenting with different ways of holding down costs, and then let's see if any of those work, which is a very irresponsible way to do this. So that we know that healthcare costs overall in this country will continue to rise, which puts pressure on employers to what do they do, especially, you know, you outlined a failing economy here in the United States. It drives employers to put more and more of the cost of healthcare onto their employees, and they can do this in a number of ways. We're seeing a lot of large employers are moving their employees into these private exchanges, so that's this whole new market of companies that will offer a variety of plans, so your business can sign up with them, and then they'll take care of enrolling your employees in plans and giving them choices. But what this does, it puts another middle person into the whole picture, which actually raises more of the administrative cost. And who's going to bear that? It's going to be the employees. So employees will be driven into these lower price plans, which have lower prices because they put more of the cost on the employee in terms of copays, deductibles, or coinsurances, or they restrict their networks so that, you know, what we're seeing a number of insurance companies do is leave out major medical centers, the ones who take care of very sick patients, especially major pediatric medical centers that take care of the most complicated problems that children can have. They don't want to contract with community types of clinics that take care of sick patients or public hospitals that take care of primarily sicker patients. So they restrict these networks. So, you know, a person may have health insurance. It's not going to be very good health insurance in terms of what it covers, but it's not even going to cover the places that you need to go if you have a really serious health problem. So these are some of the ways that they're, you know, protecting their profits, and it comes at serious, you know, financial hardship for people if they face a health problem.
So in other words, what you're saying is a lot of businesses, now that Obamacare is being implemented, are simply dropping their own coverage for their own employees, saying go to the private insurance market.
Right.
Some may provide some money. Some may say it's all up to you now.
Right.
And the folks that are going are being forced into higher deductible, higher copay arrangements for far less quality of coverage.
Right. Right. So that, and this is something that's been interesting that we've been seeing over the last number of years. So it was interesting to hear Jay Carney early in October, you know, right after the plan rolled out, saying that, you know, the Affordable Care Act is already working because we're already seeing a slowing of our overall healthcare spending. And it's true, right after the crash in 2008, we started to see a slow and a rise of our overall healthcare spending in this country. So it actually happened before the law was passed in 2010. And if we really look at why is that slowing happening, it's happening because fewer people can actually afford healthcare services. So they're not going to the doctor. They're not filling their prescriptions. If they're, have a test or a treatment ordered, they're not going ahead and getting that done because they're bearing more and more of the cost out of pocket, and people simply don't have it. You know, 2/3 of Americans don't have $1,000 on hand to handle an emergency. So how do you handle a deductible that is $1,000 or more? It's not unusual now to have a $5,000 or a $10,000 deductible that you have to pay out of pocket before your insurance even kicks in.
So yeah, another point regarding that so-called slower healthcare spending or costs and spending, that's end-user healthcare costs. That's like charges by doctors, hospitals, so on and so forth, their total charges because fewer people are going. But I don't believe that includes health insurance premium costs, does it?
Now, health insurance premiums have been steadily going up, and they will.
Yeah, that's not in those numbers of slowing healthcare spending
that
the government likes to hike. Let me just throw in, my own personal experience. I got a member of my personal family, 27 years old, was paying $107 a month for a $4,000 deductible. In other words, just a catastrophe crisis kind of thing. And now that person just got a notice from Blue Shield, standard company, Blue Shield, saying that their cost is now doubling to $213 monthly premium, and the deductible is going up to $6,350, which is the deductible under the Health Care Act. So, in other words, a 50% increase in his premium, and at the same time, no improvement in what's being charged. No improvement in coverage, same thing, double the cost, and even a higher, double the premium cost, and even a higher deductible. Now, I wonder how many people are experiencing the same thing.
Right, I imagine that we'll see even more than that. If we look at Massachusetts, which passed a very similar piece of legislation in 2006, so we can really look at what's happening there to give us a sense of what's going to happen at the national level. Between 2009 and 2011, their premiums rose by nearly 10%, but the benefits that were covered went down by 5%, and the deductibles that people had to pay, out of pocket up front, went up 40%. So their premiums rose, benefits went down, and they had to pay more out of pocket. And I think that that's a trend that we've been seeing at the national level. We'll continue to see it more under the Affordable Care Act. I think it's so important for people to understand is that having health insurance in the United States does not mean that you can get the health care that you need. It's not equivalent. Having health insurance and having access to the health care that you need are not equivalent. So while more people will have insurance, we're going to continue to see very serious financial barriers to getting the health care that they need. So it just really doesn't protect people. And the number one cause of bankruptcy in the United States is due to medical illness and medical costs. And the Affordable Care Act is really not protecting people from medical bankruptcy. Again, if we look at Massachusetts, the number of people who went into medical bankruptcy increased, has been increasing under the law that they have there. As a percentage of bankruptcies, it actually went down slightly because the recession caused more bankruptcies. But if you looked at the whole number, more people were having medical bankruptcies.
Yeah. And it's not just a question of the individually already insured, as you say, deductibles going up, copays, coverage going, quality coverage going down. There's another dimension here, and that's those who are already collectively insured. In other words, those who are on union plans, which they call Cadillac plans, most union plans, traditional union employer health care coverage, that's subject under the Act to a 40% excise tax in 2018. And what's happening, talking to my union contacts and friends, is that employers are already putting a stake in the ground and say, we're not paying any more between now and then in terms of your insurance premiums. You're going to have to pick it all up. And we're even seeing at the very top in the AFL-CIO, the leaders, presidents of their respective unions are really feeling the heat because their members are saying, hey, what is this?
Right.
And 40% excise tax, in other words, union-negotiated health care plans will disappear by 2018, no doubt. But a 40% tax, no employer is going to pay 40% tax, and no employee can afford to have that shifted, that cost shifted to them.
Right.
So the ACA means the end of union-negotiated health care plans, which, by the way, folks, that's what George W. Bush's health savings accounts privatization was all about. To me, Obamacare is just another backdoor to HSAs and privatization. What do you say to that?
I think absolutely. I think this is the point I've been trying to make when people say that the Affordable Care Act is a step forward in terms of getting towards a single-payer plan. Now, a single-payer health insurance plan, which is what we advocate for, would be a system in which every person is in it. It's paid for upfront through taxes. There's no concern about whether you're eligible, no concern about whether you have money in your pocket to get care. You just be able to get care. Moving to a universal publicly funded health care plan would solve our health care crisis. The Affordable Care Act has moved us in the opposite direction towards greater privatization of our health care, using hundreds of billions of our taxpayer dollars to subsidize. I think they're estimating $1.1 trillion of the $1.8 trillion that this plan is going to cost. $1.1 trillion is going directly into the pockets of the private insurers, public dollars, to subsidize these plans that won't protect people. I mean, we can get into it more, but I have very serious concerns about Medicaid becoming more privatized. Medicare already is becoming more privatized. Medicare is you know, one of our star public health programs for people that are 65 years of age and older. And Obama talked so much when the law was passed about getting rid of Medicare Advantage plans, which are really private insurance plans under Medicare that tend to only ensure the healthiest population, and they also cost much more than traditional Medicare. Instead of getting rid of the Medicare Advantage plans, the Obama administration is paying them more money, and we're seeing a growth with 30% more people are in Medicare Advantage plans now than were in 2010. So I think we're going to continue to see privatization of our public insurances as well.
The U.S. spends, 17-18% of its total GDP on health care?
Right, over 18% now.
And that includes the insurance companies.
Right.
If you look at it, probably, and this confirms with your statistics you just gave me, $1.1 trillion of the $1.8 trillion will go to insurance companies, the middlemen, the paper pushers, who don't deliver one iota of health care services,
right,
are ripping off most of the cost. In other words, if you look at the European nationalized health care plans, programs throughout most of Europe, Canada, and somewhere elsewhere, they pay about 10% of their GDP towards health care. We pay 17-18%.
It's 18.2, yeah.
Yeah. So 8% go to the paper pushers? What's 8% of $16 trillion, folks? That's $1.5 trillion a year in premiums going to insurance companies who pass paper around and don't deliver one iota health care services. That's the problem. These are nothing but what we call in economics rentier capitalists. They're sucking super profits away from even other companies as well as consumers and giving themselves huge increases. And what do insurance companies do with this money? Well, they're banks. They take the money, invest in Chinese property and Brazilian currencies and so forth, speculating around the globe. That's what they're doing with it. It's incredible, the ripoff that's going on with health insurance companies, and all insurance companies, really, but especially health insurance companies. Look, another question for you. I can't make sense out of what's really happening. Maybe it's too early in a rollout. In terms of the subsidies that people are supposed to get from the government and the penalties if you don't sign up. Do you have any impression of that? You know, if the penalties are too too low. In other words, if it costs much less to pay the tax in your, you know, your tax returns in April than it costs you to buy it per month now, then certain people won't sign up. They'll just pay the penalty, including businesses. They'll do the same thing. They'll just pay the penalty.
Right.
But if you don't get enrollment, then the premiums will go up for the rest who do enroll. And, of course, whether you enroll or not is also a function of what's the level of subsidies you're going to get from the government. So if the subsidies from the government are too low, and if the penalties are too low, you're not going to get people enrolling, and therefore the insurance rates for everyone else is going to go up. What can you tell at this point regarding subsidies and penalty levels? Are they discouraging enrollment, or are they encouraging it?
Well, to start with the penalty levels, you know, they start out the first year at either $95 or 1% of your income, so pretty low. So that is a penalty level that where some people may choose not to purchase health insurance and just to go ahead and pay that penalty. As in terms of the employers, if they kind of crunch the numbers, it may be cheaper for them to pay the penalties, although those penalties, actually the employer mandate was postponed, as you're probably aware, that was part of one of the concessions that the Obama administration gave, is that employers are not required in 2014 to either pay insurance or pay a penalty. But after that, you know, for businesses, it may be just cheaper to pay the penalty, and then their employees will just be left to go into the private insurance exchanges to buy the insurance that they can afford. So I think, you know, the penalties are probably not going to be effective in driving people to buy insurance. As far as the subsidies go, we'll have to see how that works out. Most people are predicting that the subsidies are not going to be adequate to help people be able to still, you know, afford health insurance. Or what we saw or see in Massachusetts is that people once they pay for their insurance premiums, they don't have any money left over to pay those copays or deductibles to actually get care. And what's interesting is that about 27% of uninsured adults in the United States don't have bank accounts. And so I'm not sure how they're even going to be able to get insurance, because a lot of these insurance plans are saying through the exchanges will only accept electronic payments. So this presents a whole other kind of barrier, I think, for people in the U.S. to get to even purchase
the subsidies.
Insurance.
You're talking about the subsidies.
No bank account to get the subsidies or to pay for their premiums. So.
Okay. Well, that's another problem with this. Is there a big difference? I know there's only 17 states, I believe, who have actually initiated state-run insurance exchanges. And the rest, the federal government has to step in and set up these exchanges. What's the status of these federal government exchanges? Are they moving forward, or all this report about people signing up is only for the 17 states?
You know, I wish I had an answer to that for you, Jack. I don't know the status of the federal exchanges. What I can say about the exchanges, which I think is really interesting, is that many of the larger insurance plans, and this is where I think that the state health insurance exchanges are just really ultimately going to fail. A number of the large insurance plans like Cigna, Aetna, United Health are really not participating in the state exchanges. I think Cigna's participating in 5, Aetna and Cigna in like 12 or 14. And what they do participate in are these private exchanges where they can, you know, which will be marketed to employers, and we know that our healthiest population is our employed population. Those are the ones that the health insurers really want to provide premiums, you know, the health insurance too, is that employed, healthy workforce. This is going to leave the private exchanges, I mean, not the private exchange, but the state exchanges, taking care of really those who can't get insurance any other way. They're going to be the ones who are sick and can't work, ones who have, you know, high health needs. And that's going to put a real burden onto those state exchanges. And I think ultimately we're going to see them, you know, have to raise their premiums, cut back on their benefits, and ultimately I think those are going to
fail. Yeah, and especially the state exchanges, public exchanges, as I understand it, and conforms to what you just said about big insurance companies, most of these state exchanges participating insurance companies are smaller companies.
Right.
So if the smaller
right.
companies are the ones who are going to take on those who are really ill, there's a real possibility that some of them will
right.
go under. That
right.
or
they
they'll
just won't have
withdraw.
The means. Right. They won't have the power to negotiate, you know, lower prices, and they're not going to have the means to handle high health care costs. So, and that this is something that we've seen, you know, we've often seen is. To think that we can actually regulate these large insurers and get them to act more, quote-unquote, responsibly and take care of sick people is just, it's been tried before, and they always find ways to get around it. I think through restricting their networks, restricting, you know, participating in the exchanges, another thing that we're likely to see them do is that they can't dump a patient now. You know, we got rid of the whole idea of rescissions of you get insurance and then you get sick and the insurance company dumps you. But what they can do is they can withdraw from a region. So if they, if you have a large insurance company and it's insuring a certain geographical area and the healthcare costs of that area starts to go up, that insurance company may just dump that area.
Well, it sounds to me from our discussion here that there's some big problems with the ACA, Obama Healthcare, and given the problems, I personally believe that the Tea Publicans don't really want to get rid of Obamacare. I think they want to keep it as a whipping post through the 2016 election. That's why they will settle, but they'll settle for big cuts in Social Security and Medicare. Okay, that's it for today, and we'll be back next week talking about, again, the debt ceiling situation. So tune in to Alternative Visions, and thank you, Margaret.